The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest Insurance Group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com, that is gsuggsinsurance.com. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Time Magazine, March 23, 2026, and March 9, 2026 editions. Both covers feature the usual format of the red border with the white narrow inner border. Time, in both cases, is in large capital block white lettering. The first is superimposed upon a pale gray, blue, almost white background. It features the eight red baseball caps that all say "Make Something Great Again." And the March 9 edition features a montage of photographs of the faces of nine individuals. Let's see, there are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 females and 3 males, the people versus AI. I'm going to finish reading first from the March 23 edition, beginning with March of the Machines under the heading Technology. This is a lengthy article which will be abbreviated. It's by Charlie Campbell, San Francisco. And then I'm going to finish this edition with something called The World's Great Places. This was compiled by Time Magazine. I won't read them all. It looks like they have several here, with some photos and some corresponding map connections with the indications of where they are on the map of the world. But first, March of the Machines, How Humanoid Robots Could Transform Modern Warfare. Again, this is long and will be abbreviated. The Phantom MK1 looks the part of an AI soldier, encased in jet black steel with a tinted glass visor. It conjures a visceral dread far beyond what may be evoked by your typical humanoid robot. And on this late February morning, it brandishes assorted high-powered weaponry, a revolver, pistol, shotgun, and replica of an M16 rifle. Okay, this thing is photographed, and it's on the title page of this article. I do not know the dimensions of it. I do not know how tall it is or how wide it is, but it looks like a fake human. There's nothing, it's not dressed or anything. It's black. It looks like black, dull coated steel. It has these artificial hands, and the head looks almost like a human head, except that it's flattish on top, and there's a visor in the front where a face would be. The chest region is broad. Almost looks like the guy has on a bulletproof vest. Well, then we don't see it, though. We don't see the rest of the torso below approximately what would be the waist. So I can't describe any legs or feet. And again, I don't know the size of the thing. Well, we think there's a moral imperative to put these robots into war instead of soldiers, says Mike LeBlanc, a 14-year Marine Corps veteran with multiple tours of Iraq and Afghanistan, who's a co-founder of Foundation, the company that makes Phantom. He says the aim is for the robot to wield any kind of weapon a human can. Today, Phantom is being tested in factories and dockyards from Atlanta to Singapore, but its headline claim is to be the world's first humanoid robot, specifically developed for defense applications. Foundation already has research contracts worth a combined $24 million with the U.S. Army, Navy, and Air Force, including what is known as an SBIR Phase 3, effectively making it an approved military vendor. It's also due to begin tests with the Marine Corps. Methods of entry course, training phantoms to put explosives on doors to help troops breach sites more safely. In February, two phantoms were sent to Ukraine, initially for frontline reconnaissance support, but Foundation's also preparing phantoms for potential deployment in combat scenarios for the Pentagon, which continues to explore the development of militarized humanoid prototypes designed to operate alongside war fighters in complex high-risk environments, says a spokesman. LeBlanc says the company is also in very close contact with the Department of Homeland Security about possible patrol functions for Phantom along the U.S. southern border. In just a few short years, the rapid proliferation of AI has turned what was once the stuff of dystopian sci-fi into a reality. LeBlanc argues humanoid soldiers are a natural extension of existing autonomous systems like drones. Compared with risking the lives of teenage grunts, with all the political backlash and risks of stress-induced war crimes and trauma, humanoid soldiers offer a more resilient alternative with greater restraint and precision. Robots do not suffer from fatigue or fear and can operate continuously in extreme conditions while immune from radiation, chemicals, or biological agents. Moreover, LeBlanc believes giant armies of humanoid robots will eventually nullify each side's tactical advantage in any conflict, much like nuclear deterrence, exponentially decreasing escalation risks. The counterargument is, however, chilling, that humanoid soldiers lower political and ethical barriers to initiating conflict, blur responsibility for any abuses, and further dehumanize warfare. Current Pentagon protocols decree automated systems can engage only with a human green light. And Foundation insists it is also its intention for Phantom. However, AI-powered drones in Ukraine are already assessing targets and autonomously firing as Russian radio jamming renders remote operation ineffective. If an adversary decides to allow the autonomous operation of AI-powered soldiers, what's to stop the U.S. and its allies from reciprocating in the fog of war? It is a slippery slope, says Jennifer Cavanaugh, director of military analysis for the Washington-based think tank Defense Priorities. The appeal of automating things and having humans out of the loop is extremely high. The lack of transparency between the two sides of any conflict creates additional concerns. Moreover, set against a drastic militarization of American society, with heavily armed ICE officers swarming U.S. cities, the National Guard deployed to six states last year, and local police equipped with armored vehicles left over from the forever wars, the specter of AI-powered soldiers with opaque mission directives and chains of command has civil liberty alarm bells clanging. Then add in the well-documented algorithmic biases that are known to blight AI facial recognition software. Yet in a sign of stripped-away guardrails for AI's national security implementation, February 28, President Donald Trump ordered federal agencies and military contractors to cease business with Anthropic, known as the most safety-conscious of the big AI firms. Anthropic's contract decreed its technology could not be used to surveil American citizens or program autonomous weapons to kill without human involvement. While both these restrictions chime with current government protocol, the White House refused to be bound by them. and the U.S. is far from alone in exploring humanoid soldiers. Authoritarian regimes, including Russia and China, are developing the dual-use technology, pitting the West in a contest to create ever more powerful and efficient killing machines in human form. A humanoid soldier arms race is already happening, says Sankayat Patak, Foundation co-founder and CEO. Modern warfare is already hugely automated, from smart mines and anti-rocket defense shields to laser-guided missiles. The question is how much autonomy is too much. As companies like Foundation race to embody humanoids with lethal functionality, a parallel legal tussle is raging between AI-focused defense companies and international bodies seeking to codify which level of human control is appropriate in war. Lethal autonomous weapon systems are politically unacceptable and morally repugnant, U.S. Secretary General Antonio Guterres said last year in remarks that seemed to put the international order on a collision course with AI-focused defense firms with influential backing. Time can reveal Eric Trump is an investor and newly appointed chief strategic advisor at Foundation. Autonomy is a spectrum, says Bonnie Doherty, a lecturer at International Human Rights Clinic at Harvard Law School. Technology is moving rapidly towards full autonomy, and there are serious concerns when life and death decisions are delegated to a machine. In Ukraine, where Vladimir Putin's war of choice has just entered its fifth year at a cost of some 350,000 lives and counting, that spectrum of autonomy has been stretched to new limits. For LeBlanc, who undertook over 300 combat missions for the Marines, what he discovered upon taking Phantom to Ukraine was really shocking, he says. It is a complete robot war, where the robot's the primary fighter and humans are in support. It is the exact opposite of when I was in Afghanistan. The humans were everything, and we had supplementary tools. Ukraine, which now launches up to 9,000 drones every day, has become the world's premier testing ground for arms manufacturers, including Western startups seeking to automate parts of the conventional kill chain. The step-by-step process used to identify, engage, and destroy an enemy target. These firms include Foundation, which wants to get Phantoms onto the front line of combat to hone the technology via a feedback loop of real-life use cases. Just like drones, machine guns, or any technology, you first have to get them into the hands of customers, says Patak. Increasingly, every aspect of the Ukraine war is being automated. Most stunning has been the proliferation of autonomous drones, which boast software that can navigate payloads over hundreds of miles and lock onto a target. AI-enhanced Ukrainian quadcopters can attack Russian soldiers without humans in the loop when communications fail and remote control becomes impossible. Computer vision can identify and eliminate specific targets, even flying through windows to assassinate individuals. In late January, three bloodied Russian soldiers emerged from a routed building to surrender to an armed Ukrainian ground robot, a kind of small, unmanned tank. LeBlanc says what he saw in Ukraine only bolsters his belief in the value of humanoid soldiers. On the front lines, troops are burrowed down in stronghold positions, but acutely vulnerable to drone attacks every time they venture outside. So humanoid soldiers could be invaluable for resupplying and reconnaissance work, especially in places drones cannot access, like low bunkers. With a heat signature like that of humans, robots like Phantom also throw off enemy surveillance. Moreover, having humanoid soldiers means existing stocks of weaponry can be deployed in their cold metal grip, rather than being rendered obsolete by robots that require purpose-built tools of their own. How many 50-caliber guns do we have? How many grenade launchers? How many Humvees? Says LeBlanc. We need something that can interact with all these, so having a humanoid really unlocks the entire U.S. military. Ultimately, wars are won by breaking the enemy's will. It can leave in body bags or as morale drains away. But even as strikes aimed at the latter, like the Russian energy infrastructure attacks that have left Ukrainians without heat, can be considered a war crime. LeBlanc argues that such moves are preferable to firebombing a human population and that they will be all that's left when humans leave the field of war. Droid battles with a bunch of drones overhead and humanoids walking out towards each other becomes an economic conflict, he says. I think that's all for the better. There are downsides. Humanoid robots are heavy and expensive, need regular recharging, and are likely to break down. How will they cope with mud, dust, and driving rain? Movement in a humanoid is driven by some 20 motors, each of which must be powered and can be rendered useless by even a minor glitch. Deploying humanoids alongside regular troops may also bring additional dangers. If you fall over next to a baby, you know how to land without hurting the baby, says Prahlad Vadakepat, an associate professor at the National University of Singapore and founder of the Federation of International Robot Soccer Association. Will a humanoid be able to do that? Some risks are operational. Already, captured drones are a significant source of sensitive data, acting as flying smartphones that store or transmit detailed intelligence. Drones can also be spoofed by having their radio frequencies intercepted. A hacked humanoid soldier presents a whole host of risks. An enemy could potentially hijack a fleet of robots through software backdoors, turning an army against its own creators, or using them to commit untraceable atrocities. Another sizable risk is a humanoid's ability to properly assess a situation. Even if the intent is to keep humans in the kill chain, infantry battles are more frantic scenarios than drone missions are. If a child runs toward you clutching open scissors, it's self-evident to humans that the threat level is minimal. Would embodied AI feel the same way, or for that matter, does it feel anything at all? It is a question of human dignity, says Peter Asaro, a roboticist, philosopher, and chair of the International Committee for Robot Arms Control. These machines are not moral or legal agents, and they will never understand the ethical implications of their actions. All right, that article was abridged. And now I'm moving on to the world's greatest places, according to Time. I will read most of their names, but I will not read all of their descriptions. Deer Valley, that's D-E-E-R, Resort, Park City, Utah. Six Senses, Lamu Atoll, Maldives. Songtsam Lodge, Chisholm, Yunnan, China. I'm going to read this one. Opening Doors to the Hinterlands by Adam H. Graham. China's rapid urbanization has drawn people and investment toward megacities like Shanghai and Shenzhen, leaving much of rural China with its vast wilderness and deep-rooted traditions less accessible to visitors. Now travelers are venturing farther out to the country's remote regions. Rural areas have experienced a surge of visitors in the post-COVID years because of increased government infrastructure and a growing desire among Chinese urbanites to escape the cities, according to China's Culture and Tourism Ministry. The country's recent easing of tourist visa rules with an expanded 10-day visa-free policy that allows travel across multiple regions for visitors from over 50 countries also helped. Founded by Yunnan native Baima Duoji, a former CCTV documentary filmmaker, Songtsam Resort Group is leading the push. The upmarket independent brand has cultivated a network of 18 inns throughout rural China. Following a meticulous two-year renovation, Songtsam Lodge, Xishong, is one of its newest entrants. It reopened in August in the southwestern province of Yunnan, set at 7,208 feet elevation in the eastern Himalayas. The contemporary stone and wood resort sits amid walnut trees and prayer flags on the steep banks of the Lankang River, Upper Mekong. As the brand's first wine resort, it pays homage to French missionaries who brought winemaking to the region in 1867. Yet today it remains a vibrant mix of Tibetan, Han, Bai, and Noxi traditions, where visitors can experience excursions to the alpine lakes at Nanjiluo, private vineyard tastings, and local meals with lashings of butter tea, smoked and preserved pipa meat, and rice and vegetable dishes cooked in walnut oil. The expansion took the property to 26 rooms, each with carved wooden window frames, locally woven rugs, and private balconies that overlook the river and vineyards that grow Chardonnay, Cabernet Sauvignon, and Meguimi, a native tannic red grape. My father's passionate about Tibetan culture, nature, and storytelling, says Baima's daughter, Florence Lee, Songtsam's vice president. In 2000, he turned our ancestral home into Songtsam Lodge, Shangri-La. By creating this brand and expanding it throughout the Himalayas, we are able to continue his mission of championing Tibetan and local cultures. The brand's pipeline of developments furthers its reputation for revitalizing rural Chinese culture in places that rarely see thoughtful, high-end development. A new Yading route, launched in 2024, brings visitors to previously inaccessible Himalayan trekking paths, home to Tibetan monasteries and rare flora and fauna like golden snub-nosed monkeys, snow leopards, red pandas, and blue poppies. The Songtsam Lhenkha Retreat, slated to open this spring in Kunming, is designed by 2012 Pritzker laureate Wang Shu, with a spa and Tibetan-inspired treatments. Moving along now, with other great places in the world, according to Time, Hus Quell by Oppenzeller Hus, Ganten, Switzerland. Turning the page, Masaya's Camp at Royal Malawane, Kruger National Park, South Africa. Estancia Mercedes, Puerto Natales, Chile. Surf Abu Dhabi, Abu Dhabi. Mana Living, Kyoto. Creative Craft by Rebecca Pepler. Opened in September, Ma'ana Living is a design-forward boutique that introduces visitors to the world of Ma'ana, a hospitality brand shaped by Japanese craft and tradition. Wooden shelves and a low central table display delicate ceramic teacups, bamboo vessels, warosuku candles, and incense sourced from Japan's oldest incense maker. Traditional to Chuchikabe walls showcase hand-twisted Orozaiku straw crafts, while pendant lights from Kyoto-based sculptor Ren Nakane lend the space a soft warmth. Founded by childhood friends Hana Tsukamoto and Irene Chang, Ma'ana Living functions as both shop and entry point. Many of the objects for sale also appear inside Ma'ana Homes, the brand's collection of renovated Machiya townhouses across the city. Ma'ana Atelier hosts hands-on workshops in the historic Nishijin district, while immersive multi-day retreats focused on food, home design, or pottery let visitors learn techniques from the artisans behind the work. Turning the page, Silo Lona Sojourns, Sidatu Bua, Senderawasi Bay, Indonesia, V&A East Storehouse, London, House of Tan Yuk Ni, Singapore, Janane Karwan, Marrakesh, Morocco, A City Desert Camp, by Cynthia Rosenfeld. Marrakesh's Zelliga tile design scene is booming, and one newcomer hotel stands out. Opened in October, Janane Karwan is a tented desert retreat conceived by Senegalese West Indian hospitality pioneer Marianne Loom Martin to elevate Amazigh, Berber nomad, culture. Set among rammed earth ruins, Karwan comprises five tents, four for guests, including two with private pools, plus a gallery space for events, furnished with art and antiques from across the Maghreb. Guests have the run of the oasis, from the heated swimming pool to shaded gathering spaces. Programming includes events like an annual diaspora salon, bringing artists, writers, and cultural figures of African ancestry together. This blend of place, purpose, and lived culture makes Janane Karwan one of the city's most meaningful new stays. Turning the page, Norden Camp, Gan'an, Tibetan Autonomous Prefecture, China. Universal Epic Universe, Orlando, the theme park to end all theme parks, by Terry Ward. The 110-acre Universal Epic Universe, Universal Orlando Resort's fourth park and the first new theme park to open in Orlando in a quarter century, lives up to the hype. Guests enter each of its five themed worlds through immersive portals. In Super Nintendo World, visitors pop through the green warp pipe into the Mushroom Kingdom, then choose their own adventure. One rattles through Donkey Kong Country, while another turns an augmented reality race into a coin-collecting game. The Showstopper sets belong to Wizarding World of Harry Potter, Ministry of Magic, and its 1920s Parisian streetscapes, while talking portraits and animatronics entertain queuing guests at the battle at the Ministry Ride. For extreme thrills, Stardust Racers, a dual-launch coaster, speeds up to 62 miles per hour. Other worlds orbit a fantastical carousel. Three new Universal hotels also opened in 2025. Aurora Expeditions, Douglas, Mawson, The Southern Ocean, Polar Trip, by Johnny Bierman. There's a photo here of ice. The cruise industry has long overlooked and often penalized solo travelers with hefty single supplements, the charge paid by those who board without a buddy. But Aurora Expeditions has eliminated single supplements across its fleet and offers 10 single-occupancy staterooms per voyage on each of its three ships. The Douglas Mawson, launched in December, even includes dedicated solo cabins. named for the man who led Australia's first major scientific expedition to Antarctica in 1911, the 154-passenger ship marks Aurora's return to East Antarctica for the first time in 15 years. Sustainability is built into the ship's design. Its wave-piercing hull reduces fuel consumption. GPS-powered virtual anchoring protects fragile seabeds. And industry-first microfiber filtration captures 99% of laundry microplastics, according to the company. Aurora also funds kelp planting and waste removal for every passenger. Next page, Art Zoo, Amsterdam, and beyond, Suion Lodge, Suion Conservancy, Kenya. Hotel Plesnik, Solkava, Slovenia. Oberoi Rajgarh Palace, Rajgarh, India. Netflix House, Philadelphia. King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. I'll read this one. It's by Kate Springer. It's kind of long. You're posing on a red velvet Bridgerton throne. You're following Wednesday's severed sidekick thing into a haunted carnival. In November, Netflix opened its first permanent destination, Netflix House Philadelphia, an immersive two-story venue where familiar on-screen worlds spill out of the living room and into the wider world. It's a new model for streamers, which have only dipped toes into the physical world. Marion Lee, Netflix's chief marketing officer, says the expansion into experimental entertainment gained momentum during the pandemic, after Netflix held its Stranger Things drive-in to experience in 2020. We did not really anticipate that level of rabidness, she says. Since then, the company has rolled out hundreds of in-person experiences around the world, including Bridgerton balls and K-pop Demon Hunters sing-alongs. We decided this is worth doing on a more permanent basis, Lee says. Not wanting to go full Disney World, Netflix opted for a more intimate and accessible and Instagrammable experience. Housed in a former department store at King of Prussia Mall, about 25 minutes outside Philadelphia, the more than 100,000-square-foot space is free to explore. Visitors pass through a massive red envelope, a nod to the brand's early DVD-by-mail days, to a colorful atrium overflowing with artwork and show props. From gilded Love is Blind goblets to menacing Squid Game guards, the space is engineered for photo ops. Is it one big marketing campaign? Yes. Does that make it any less fun for fans? No. Hour-long paid adventures bring together meticulous set design and interactive storytelling. In the one-piece experience, teams race through themed rooms, each with a puzzle to solve, in pursuit of the elusive devil fruit. Across the hall, Wednesday, Eve of the Outcasts, drops fans into a delightfully eerie carnival at Nevermore Academy, complete with bewitched games, a murder mystery, and a secret passage to explore. Three VR gaming rooms, a mini golf course inspired by shows like Is It Cake? And Bridgerton, a 229-seat theater for screenings and live events, and a stylish restaurant serving dishes and drinks inspired by Netflix productions like the Jumbo Plot Twist Pretzel or WWE Smashed Burger, make Netflix House a bona fide destination. And Philadelphia's just the beginning. Netflix House Dallas opened in December with the same free-to-enter, pay-as-you-go model. Each location has unique exhibits, and there visitors can try a Stranger Things rescue mission, Squid Game challenges, and replay an interactive arcade. The next Netflix House, Las Vegas, will open in 2027, and Lee hopes to expand from there, but the company has no plans to pursue the mega park model. I would love for this to be so successful that we're in every major city around the world, Lee says. We want it to be a neighborhood hangout, a community place you can come back to again and again. And moving on, Tina Johnny, Altiplano, Peru. Varg Sail Yacht, Norway. Sail the Arctic by Terry Ward. I'll stop for this one. We're nearing the end. With its obsidian black hull and sails, Varg Sail Yacht cuts a striking figure in Norway's wintry fjords. The 62-foot sailing yacht carries just 6 guests in its 3 cabins, a contrast to the cruise ship behemoths that ply these waters. Built specifically for expeditions above the Arctic Circle, Varg is helmed by a 3-person crew with deep experience sailing Greenland and Svalbard, and features include a reinforced bow strengthened by a steel rod running to the keel for added protection in ice. Inside, the mood is pure hygge, a toasty saloon with a fireplace and wraparound windows to watch the landscape slide past. After days outdoors, guests warm up in a wood-fired sauna below deck or a hot tub up top. New year-round itineraries from Norona Adventure range from winter orca and humpbacked whale safaris in the Barents Sea, when the northern lights frequently shimmer overhead, to spring ski and sail trips in the Lingen Alps. Summer brings exploration of the Lofoten Archipelago, reaching remote areas accessible only by sea. Turning the page, Flockhill, Craigieburn Valley, New Zealand. Lime Out St. Thomas, Lindbergh Bay St. Thomas, Bia Seoul, Ha Long Bay, Vietnam, Avant-Garde, Refined Caves of Cappadocia, Turkey, and Ephedra Restaurant, San Pedro de Atacama, Chile. Now to the March 9 edition of Time. I'm working backwards. Time Off. A review. Midlife Loneliness. There's an app for that. By Judy Berman. Two very disparate stories intertwine uncomfortably in the HBO miniseries DTF St. Louis. In one, a man is found dead at a community pool near an empty canned cocktail and a vintage playgirl. The other traces a friendship between two middle-aged male co-workers, both of whom are exploring infidelity, one by having an affair with the other's wife. The cuckold and the murder victim are the same man, Floyd Smirnich, a gentle sign language interpreter, loving stepdad, and paunchy sad sack, played by Stranger Things' David Harbour. His death gives shape to the plot, which braids together the police investigation with relevant flashbacks. It also places undue emphasis on the least intriguing aspects of the show, wringing another murder mystery out of what could have been a nuanced drama of midlife love and friendship. Within moments of meeting TV weatherman Clark Forrest, Jason Bateman, a health-conscious alpha who traverses St. Louis on a recumbent bike, Floyd saves him from a stop sign sent flying by a storm. This is not unusual for our soon-to-be-deceased hero, who regularly risks injury and embarrassment to help people. At group therapy with his troubled stepson, Richard Arlen Ruff, Floyd bears his soul. "It's okay. I also got C's in school," he tells the boy. He wants to prevent Richard from getting what he calls grown-up C's, that is, an unsatisfying life. Frustrated with his finances, his body, and the widening gulf in his marriage, Floyd is evidently speaking from experience. Although we are not initially clear on the order of events, Clark befriends Floyd and starts sleeping with his wife, Carol, Linda Cardellini, TV's laureate of complicated middle-aged women. Presumably to assuage his guilt, Clark talks his buddy into downloading DTF St. Louis, an app for married locals looking for discreet hookups. When Floyd's body's found, the service becomes a crucial tool for two cops investigating the case. Richard Jenkins Homer, a veteran detective who leans on lazy assumptions, and young, open-minded Jody, Joy Sunday, who insists on following the evidence wherever it may lead. It premiered March 1, and DTF is a tricky show, one whose apparent inconsistencies might turn out to be deliberate choices. It has an offbeat, sometimes surreal, sense of humor. The writing and acting alternate between stylized stiffness and heart-wrenching realism. Floyd comes across as a purely kind soul, making his willingness to cheat on his wife seem out of character. Clark and Carol's authentic selves are, by contrast, buried under layers of artifice. It often feels as though creator Steve Conrad, Patriot, is purposely hiding the perspectives of other key characters. Four episodes into the seven-part series, it's no easier to predict where all this tenderness and pain might lead than it was at the outset. As sharp as the interplay between Jenkins and Sunday can be, I cannot muster much curiosity about how Floyd died. More fascinating are the lines that connect each point on the love triangle, the way Clark and Carol guiltily worship Floyd's goodness, the so-called dream meetings where the cheaters engage in dominant-submissive role play, the astounding variety and flexibility of human sexuality. The murder is, at best, a distraction from what makes DTF unique. At worst, it's a crutch supporting three characters whose creator failed to build them into a less conventional plot. What if every drama did not have to be a crime drama? What if the human heart, with all its competing emotions and desires, were mystery enough? Again, in Time Off. This is going to be by Stephanie Zakarik, I think. Let me look here. Yep. And the tagline is Variations on a Theme by Stephanie Zakarik. A new Wuthering Heights adaptation joins a rich history of cinematic reimaginings. The mark of a great, tough book may not be how many literature classes it's taught in, but how many film or TV adaptations you can drape on its branches without breaking them. Dramatizations are tricky business. No film viewing experience can match the way an individual imagination, yours or mine, brings a writer's words to life. Yet dogged faithfulness is not the goal either. A film can be spiritually faithful to a book, even when it jettisons whole shards of plot. A good adaptation is a lover, not a fighter. It entwines itself with the work rather than clawing away at it. When Emily Bronte's 1847 wind-thrashed sycamore of a novel, Wuthering Heights, holds power, even over those who have not read it. No wonder filmmakers have been drawn to it almost since the advent of movies, beginning with the first known version, a 1920 British silent, now lost, and ending for now with Emerald Fennell's candy-colored bodice ripper starring Margot Robbie and Jacob Elordi, which barely holds a dripping Gothic candle to any of the others, but more on that later. That means whether you've read the middle Bronte sisters novel or not, there is a Wuthering Heights film or TV dramatization for you. In fact, there are dozens, including a 1988 Japanese incarnation, a 2015 retelling set in a California high school, and several versions from India, a Bollywood musical among them. That said, not everyone loves Bronte's book. For every reader who adores its intricate plot and discomforting view of humanity, there's at least one more who trudged through it in high school or college, never to return. Yet its polarizing effect may be the key to its magnetism. Even those who dislike it have certainly absorbed some of its fragrant dolorousness into their bones, and although scholars are still debating whether Bronte set out to write a romance, she may have been more fixated on dissecting Victorian societal strictures. Nearly everyone connects with the romantic, if dangerous, allure of the lovers at heart of this story. There's Kathy, the spirited Yorkshire lass, who's fully in tune with the brutal, beautiful landscape in which she was born, though she also yearns for genteel comforts, and Heathcliff, the outsider of low birth, who grows into a vengeful young man, and let's just admit it, a smoldering symbol of unattainability and hotness. Did I mention their imperishable bond involves necrophilia and an angry ghost? Though Bronte could have imagined the idea of movies in her lifetime, she could not have imagined the idea of movies in her lifetime, she created two characters, living, breathing phantoms of our own faults and desires, who were made for this particular interplay of shadow and light. Let's start with Peter Kosminski's 1992 film, which features two dazzling stars, Juliette Binoche and Ralph Fiennes, yet is curiously inert on the screen. It also highlights some of the problems of adapting this elaborately plotted work, a high-wire act on Bronte's part that involves a multi-generational revenge scheme and meshing Kathy's daughter and Heathcliff's son, individuals born of the two lovers mixing with outsiders. Unless you're mounting a 10-episode miniseries, some plot points will have to go, but Kosminski's reading is just too truncated. And although Robert Firth's 1970 version, starring future James Bond, Timothy Dalton, has the nastiest psychosexual undertones of the 10 adaptations addressed here, it's still a dud. Dalton's wily Heathcliff, though handsome, is not particularly alluring. For a compact yet full-bodied blast of the Wuthering Heights experience, try the relatively faithful 2009 BBC adaptation, starring Tom Hardy and Charlotte Riley, who met on set and became a couple in real life. Their scenes together have an erotic earthiness unmatched by almost any other on-screen Heathcliff-Kathy combo. Which Wuthering Heights best matches the story's jagged, haunting landscape to the fighting spirit of its central lovers? That would be Andrea Arnold's 2011 version, starring James Howson and Kaya Scodelario. Though Bronte described Heathcliff as being dark, and it's generally assumed that he's meant to be Romani, or perhaps Irish, Arnold entertains another possibility. In this chilly, bracing reading, Heathcliff's a black man, a choice that reinforces his outsider status. And for sheer spookiness, Peter Sosde's 1967 made-for-BBC TV Wuthering Heights, starring Angela Scular and Deadwood's Ian McShane, is calling across the moor. This four-part series demands patience. It's one of the few adaptations that attempt loyally to Bronte's plot, and it sometimes feels stiff and stagey. But the fact that it exists only in a spectral black-and-white version, the original color version no longer exists, makes it weirdly haunting. Sosti went on to direct several Hammer horror films, and its sound design is killer. The howling winds of the countryside figure in nearly every scene, indoors and out. This is also the version that inspired Kate Bush to write Wuthering Heights, a song that captures, like the flame inside a well-cut jewel, the story's romantic obsessiveness. Bronte's novel has so much atmospheric power, it can survive translation to settings beyond hardscrabble Yorkshire. New wave master Jacques Rivette's languorously alluring 1985 version sets the story in the sun-dappled Cévennes region of France, and Louis Buñuel's deliciously named 1954 adaptation, Abismos de Passion, generates even more heat. Irasema, de Leon, and Jorge Mistral bring shimmering mid-century glamour to a story set in a hot, shrubby, yet frequently rain-swept desert. Yet of all the Wuthering Heights adaptations, two stand tall. If befitting the story, they are still admirably twisted. David Skinner's 1998 version, made for British TV and starring Robert Cavanaugh and Orla Brady, as well as a young pre-Pride and Prejudice Matthew McFadden, leans into Heathcliff's cruelty by including crucial details, the way, for instance, he confesses to having killed a nestful of baby lapwings by placing a net over their nest, preventing their parents from reaching them. This Wuthering Heights is visually gratifying. You've never seen more fabulous moonlit curls than on Kathy's ghost, while also being a little florid and suitably sick. But the finest Wuthering Heights is also perhaps the most famous and, in terms of plot, possibly the least complete. In his 1939 version, William Wyler shaves away huge chunks of the story. But his lead characters breathe on the screen, as they do in no other adaptation. Merle Oberon captures both Kathy's capacity for earthbound delight and her desire for earthly finery. You might disapprove of her, but you cannot hate her. And Laurence Olivier may be the most sympathetic of all on-screen Heathcliffs. With his stern brow and unyielding gaze, you know he's bad news, but his vulnerability is implied. Oliver Olivier's Heathcliff is the ultimate I-can-fix-him boyfriend, not a good model for reality, but deeply alluring in fiction. Which brings us to Emerald Fennell's fan fiction Wuthering Heights. Fennell has said her version is intended not as a faithful recreation, but a reimagining, a good starting point for any adaptation. As the critic Robin Wood once put it, to reduce a great novel to its plot is merely to reveal a total incapacity for reading it. But that does not mean you have to love Fennell's creation. Her Kathy and Heathcliff, played by the admittedly gorgeous Robbie and Elordi, play slapstick jokes on each other, including a bit involving raw eggs. This and some running to and fro through the craggy countryside is supposed to indicate their connection to nature's raw power. There's lots of clandestine sex after being separated and reunited. This Heathcliff and Kathy go at it like cartoony rabbits, but no carnality. Their assignations bump along methodically, PowerPoint style. Even Kathy's wardrobe disappoints. After she leaves the gloomy homestead where she and Heathcliff were raised and moves into her rich husband's house, she's decked out in a series of stiff, shiny dresses that look to have emerged from the $1.99 per yard fabric bin, beloved by broke community theater costumers everywhere. Fennell also chooses not to show Heathcliff digging up and embracing Kathy's corpse, a missed cinematic opportunity if ever there were one. And there are no ghosts here, though you will see a random hanged corpse with one body part that's slow to die. Bronte's Wuthering Heights is a bleak book, but it's not an ugly one. Beneath its cloud cover of misanthropy, there's feral, wildflower, grace. Fennell has tossed all that out, substituting her own unimaginative vision, plus a bunch of crappy dresses. A pretty dismal Valentine to a book a filmmaker ostensibly loves. This Wuthering Heights is hate reading in movie form. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.